The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists Annual Convention and Scientific Sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the Annual Clinical Assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Caron, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. The ASH Choosing Wisely program, Inferior Vena Cava Filters, is presented by Dr. Kevin Hubbard.
Thank you, Dr. Lubenthal, and good morning, everybody. I think I'm the only thing standing between you and lunch. That's a dangerous place to stand, particularly on the last full day of a national meeting, so I'm going to be cognizant of that, and I promise we'll finish on time. Or else. In the last 48 hours, I haven't gotten into bed with anybody other than my wife, and so I just wanted to reassure you nothing's changed since my last presentation with respect to financial disclosures. So what we're going to try to accomplish in our time together over the next half hour or so is to see if we can understand a little bit better the indications for IVC filter placement. We're going to describe the complications as a result of IVC filter placement, and I think I have an interesting story to tell you about that as we get started. And lastly, we're going to outline a strategy for the management of IVC filters in appropriately selected patients. Now, contrary to popular belief, these things do work. So if you think I'm going to walk in here and talk to you about Dr. Emmett Brown, make comments like, you know, this damn thing doesn't work at all. No, I'm not going to be saying that. What I am going to be telling you is I think that we need to be very careful that we select the proper patients for this device and to make sure that we're good stewards of what we're putting in to our patients. I think it's important that we try to understand that a little bit better. But we do get IT problems every now and then. You know what happens? There's no such thing as a perfect conference, and ours has been much, much smoother thanks to our outstanding IT staff this year. But every once in a while, sometimes you get caught, and that's kind of your take when you're the speaker and you're trying to fight through a laptop that doesn't want to cooperate. So I want to tell you a story about a patient that I had several years ago. This was a very delightful lady who had red hair and freckles, was middle-aged, had fought through stage 3 breast cancer. She was an artist, a very, very lovely lady. And she has a history. She presents for an elective laparoscopic oophorectomy for an ovarian mass that was found on a routine examination by her gynecologist, who subsequently performs an ultrasound and CT scan, with a radiologist. If you get one, it would have been better if you'd order the other. Clinical correlation strongly recommended, and so consequently, we spent a little bit of money down in radiology and got these tests that indicated that she had about a 20% likelihood for malignancy. Obviously, that's a concern, and so of necessity, there's a plan for excision and further plans based on what we find out at that time. Now, this patient has a remote history of antiphospholipid syndrome, probably dating back 15 or 20 years. She had been followed by us in the office. She'd had serial negative serologies for antiphospholipid syndrome, had not manifested any evidence of it, no history of thromboembolic episodes in many, many years. In fact, if anything, when she had had minor surgical procedures, she had had a tendency to bleed, and in times rather excessively. She had not required transfusions for her bleeds, but because of this, we went ahead and initiated a workup, and she had a very common disorder known as storage pool disease, which many of you may know as the aspirin-like platelet defect. These platelets have some difficulty going through a process of aggregation and subsequently forming a good base for the fibrin lattice work to develop on top of that. So as a result of that, with us managing her situation, and because she has an underlying platelet disorder, transfusing platelets at the appropriate time in minimal amounts necessitating a successful anticoagulation in keeping with the recommendations that our previous speaker made, we were very good stewards of that. We'd also treated her in our office for stage 3 breast cancer. She had been in complete remission for over 10 years. So as you can tell, we knew this patient very, very well. And because of the experiences that she had had, particularly more recently with the development of a spinal cord syrinx and acquired syringomyelia and the chronic pain that her primary care internist was managing, we got to know this lady very well. And our office visits frequently would last 30 or 45 minutes. And she would create artwork and drop it off at the office. And literally over the years, probably a third of our waiting room had been stocked with the works that she had done. Very, very gifted, very, very talented lady. Now, the problems then begin to develop because the gynecologist has expressed concern about the risk for thromboembolic disease postoperatively. This lady has multiple medical problems. She does have a history. And back in Missouri, we don't say that people are obese. We say that they're fluffy. So she was rather fluffy. Call was placed to the vascular surgeon by the surgical gynecologist who suggested an IVC filter be placed. I might add that there was no call placed to her other physicians. The patient had requested that our service be involved. We were not notified. The vascular surgeon puts in an IVC filter because she's not a candidate for anticoagulation. And in fact, it says that right on the chart. This patient is not a candidate for postoperative anticoagulation. Therefore, we're putting in the filter. What happened in the wake of that was that this patient nearly exsanguinates. She had a retroperitoneal bleed as a result of her IVC filter placement. She had a small rent that had been placed that had occurred in the posterior portion of the IVC, and she subsequently nearly bled to death as a result of this. She received, you know, a small amount of blood, approximately 10 units of packed red blood cells, and 10 units of single donor platelets, and you know, to round it all off, she received 4 units of fresh frozen plasma because she was literally exsanguinating right before us. Now, what's really interesting about this is that this lady had no contraindications to low molecular weight heparin or any of the alternatives that would have been available to us at the time. Now, the rest of the story is that her sister was an ICU nurse and worked as a nurse manager, and so I saw this lady on a regular basis at the hospital, even between visits with her sister, had a very good working relationship with her. And she calls me when she finds out that I'm at an outreach clinic about an hour east of town. Why was I at the outreach clinic? Because none of this information that I've just provided you was known to me at the time. So I'm an hour away, and she calls me and says, "My sister is bleeding to death. Where are you?" Well, I had no idea what she was talking about. And so she told me this story. She says, "You know, you promised that we'd make sure that there was a thing. You promised we'd be there." Well, if you don't know about something, how on earth can you make the plans to be there to support your patient who's having the problem if this terrible thing occurs? If it was up to us, it wouldn't have happened in the first place, and we're going to talk about why that wouldn't happen. So I come to the hospital, cancel the clinic, get there as soon as I can, and she said, "I understand the surgeon made this comment. The vascular surgeon decided this was going to happen." And I said, "Yes." The sister was not happy. She began with her strong assertion that the surgeon's parents were never married, and it went downhill from there. So the question, did you call my hematologist? No, no contact with us prior to the procedure. The next question is, well, why did I bleed? Well, again, she'd had a small perforation in her inferior vena cava. Fortunately, it healed on its own without need for surgical intervention. And of course, she has this underlying bleeding disorder with storage pool disease, which we were able to correct with her platelets that now work to try to get the whole process started and to try to seal the leak as quickly as we could. And so fortunately, she did very well. But there is some underlying intellectual pathology here that I think we want to think through, because I think we find ourselves, I certainly find myself in that same track periodically based upon the fact that I've been doing this for a while. This patient, if you look at her risk of thrombosis, she had no contraindication to routine prophylaxis, thus the reason for the filter. In fact, her history strongly suggested that when she had had surgery postoperatively, even despite her storage pool disease, she'd done very well with low molecular weight heparin, no bleeding at all by history. Her risk was also not increased as a result of her history of antiphospholipid syndrome. She had had negative serologies monitored periodically for several years. She also didn't have a risk factor for thrombosis based upon her breast cancer because she'd been in remission for more than 10 years. So her risk of bleeding was increased as a result of her storage pool disease. So there really wasn't a contraindication to doing the common sense things that we would do in a patient in this situation. So my goodness, with all that as a backdrop, we might ask ourselves how this got started. Where did we go when we started off with IVC filters? Well, back in the 1960s, IVC filters were introduced as a physical device intended to impede the embolization of deep venous thromboses. In the 1970s, as a result of some early studies, all of which were pretty much anecdotal and single institution based, there was increasing placement opportunities. And the concept that at that time was, we're going to try to address intraoperative and postoperative risk of DVT in high-risk surgery patients. So this was really driven forward based on the surgeons trying to find better ways to prevent postoperative pulmonary emboli. In the 1980s, which is in the era that I trained, there was increasing use in patients who had DVT or PE who were at an increased risk for systemic anticoagulation. And then into the 1990s, the thought process continued to mature, and we noticed at that point that we began to see that there were increasing reports of adverse events. Vessel erosion, device embolization, and some of those things happened going forward. We then look into the early 2000s, the early 21st century, the pre-PIC study group information was published in Circulation, and we're going to take a look at that data momentarily. In 2010, the FDA then issued a safety alert that said inferior vena cava filters were potentially problematic in that there was an increased risk of adverse events with long-term use. And just kind of keep the thought long-term use in the back of your mind here. In 2013, based upon information that came out from pre-PIC and with pre-PIC 2 data that we'll also take a look at coming out, the American Society of Hematology Choosing Wisely campaign began to make its recommendations, and careful consideration of IVC filter placement was then recommendation number 3 in that 2013 guideline. Now, just to be fair, before you think I'm up here to totally bash IVC filters, I have to tell you that I do have some skin in the game here. Back when I was a fellow, I was approached by Jim Abruzzese, who was one of my trainers and GI oncologist, about the concept of utilizing an inferior vena cava filter in cancer patients who were felt to be essentially terminally ill and poor risks for anticoagulation. So we worked with Dr. Jack Rome, who was an interventional radiologist across the street at Methodist Hospital. Jack had developed this bird's nest filter, and so we began to work together, and I reported on about 23 patients who had had this device successfully placed. And of course, you know, it was a glowing result. We didn't see any evidence of bleeding complications. We didn't see any filter complications. Everything looked just great. That was our very small patient cohort. But 23 cases at that time, back when this was reported in 1994, that 23 patient panel was actually the largest cohort that had ever been reported in terms of inferior vena cava filters. So even though it was essentially a single institution cohort, you have to look at this and say, gee whiz, 23 patients, that wouldn't hold any water at all these days. And you'd be absolutely right. This is not good, reliable data. But at the time, man, it was the largest series in the history of anybody looking at inferior vena cava filters. And so I think we learned a great deal on that basis. So let's take a look at the pre-PIP study group experience. This, again, was published in Circulation in 2005. This was 400 patients who had proximal DVT. They may or may not have had pulmonary embolus. And they were randomized to whether or not a filter had been placed in conjunction with systemic anticoagulation per the guidelines at the time. I think we all know if we've done this for a while, those guidelines do change a bit over the course of time. And we followed those patients for up to 8 years. Events were reviewed by an independent committee that were blinded to the randomization, and we got 99% data retrieval, which is pretty good. So 396 patients were involved in that. And here's what the data looked like. If you looked at those patients who had symptomatic pulmonary embolus, we're talking about 24 in the no filter group and 9 in the filter group. Wow, looks pretty good. What about the incidence of deep venous thrombosis in those patients? Well, the no filter group, there were 41 events versus 57 events with the patients who had the filter placed, and that was statistically significant according to the study design. There really wasn't a tremendous amount of difference in post-thrombotic syndrome or mortality at 8 years. And so when you pull the data away and you say, well, what do I take away from this? Well, the IVC filters definitely reduce the risk of pulmonary embolism at 8 years, but they increase the risk for further deep venous thromboses compared to just routine systemic anticoagulation. Really surprising when you consider the systemic anticoagulation was also permitted in the group that had the filters. IVC filters also offered no additional benefits to survival beyond guideline-based anticoagulation. They could be beneficial in patients at high risk of pulmonary embolism, but systematic use in the general population was generally not recommended based on the studies when they took a look at that. So, as a result, I've mentioned that the Choosing Wisely campaign took a look at this. If we take a look at what the existing guidelines were when this report was issued, the main indication was an acute venous thromboembolism plus a contraindication to any sort of anticoagulation. And here we had two specialty societies, the American College of Chest Physicians and the American Society of Hematology, issuing the same consensus recommendation. Another possible indication for IVC filters was for pulmonary embolism despite appropriate therapeutic anticoagulation. I think a few of us have been in that situation. We'd understand that that would probably be reasonable. Or in those patients who have massive pulmonary emboli with poor cardiopulmonary reserve, these are the people who are on the twig. You know, one little thing, you've joust the limb and that's what's going to kill the patient. These people just, they can't handle any more clot load, so this is the right thing to do, we would think, in that patient population. The filters had been placed for primary prophylaxis of PE in patients who do not have acute deep venous thrombosis or widely used without evidence really to support their utility. And based upon what we've seen, there is some clear evidence that such filters can cause harm. So let's talk a little bit about that. What sort of harm might we look at? Well, one of the trials that I think is important to think about is the Michigan Bariatric Surgery Collaborative Experience. This was published in Annals of Surgery back in 2010. And if you think about patients who have bariatric surgery, any of you ever see that series, My 600-Pound Life? I don't know if very many of you watch it. I watch it. I've watched every episode because I don't want to be a patient on that show. So, you know, I saw the first episode, set down my half gallon of ice cream, put it in the freezer, and swore I wasn't going to touch the rest of it for a week. That's a population of patients that really are at high risk. They're obese. They have poor cardiopulmonary reserve. They don't move around very well. Their surgery is going to be protracted, and their post-op recovery is going to be protracted. This is a population that you'd think, man, they got every risk factor that you could possibly think of. And a lot of those patients have already had venous thromboembolic events. So what did we find in those patients who decided to have filters put in? Well, post-op venous thromboembolism was actually doubled in the patients who had the filter versus the patients who didn't. And if you look at serious combined complications, the complication rate was twice in the filter group what it was in the non-filter group. What about death or permanent disability? Again, double in the filter group versus the non-filter group. So the takeaway, I think, from this study is very concerning because IVC filters in this patient population, morbidly obese, older patients who were deconditioned, having long surgical procedures, it didn't reduce the incidence of venous thromboembolism. In fact, the risk was increased compared to the non-filter group. Patients with IVC filters also had an increased risk of serious complications, long-term disability, and death as a result of device placement. Third thing, the cost of patient care was increased as a result of device placement. Well, in the modern era, that really resonates with us because we're often told to be stewards of patients' hospital stays as well, and we have to be good stewards to make sure that our funds are being used judiciously. So here's a concern based on this population. So if we take a look at what the estimates of filter placement are in this country, there's about 250,000 IVC filters placed in the country each year. Well, what about filters placed in accordance with guidelines? Well, only about 5,000 of these 250,000 filters were placed in accordance with nationally established guidelines. 245,000 filters are placed outside of the guidelines. So this is a real challenge for us because now we have to deal with this data and with some information that suggests that we probably need to look at our stewardship a little bit better here. It's also a challenge in big hospitals where you have medical patients as well. You know, the Boston Medical Center experience, this was published a little bit more recently, this was in JAMA Internal Medicine in 2013, 74 venous thrombotic events occurred in their institution after IVC filter placement, including 25 pulmonary emboli. Those 25 pulmonary emboli, all of them occurred with the IVC filter in place. There were 679 retrievable IVC filters placed, which is, you know, it's a pretty substantial amount. 58 of those were successfully removed. That's only about 8.5% of their total filter placement group. In fairness to the hospital and their physicians, there were unsuccessful attempts made in about another 18% of that patient population. So they tried to fish it out, just couldn't get it out because of other complications. 48% of the venous thrombotic events in this patient population were in patients without venous thromboembolism at the time of the filter placement. 89.4% occurred in patients not receiving any anticoagulation. So it does kind of make you think. Selected complications also included inferior vena cava, perforation with retroperitoneal hemorrhage, filter migration, filter fracture. These things do happen on a documented basis of several percent per year. Many of these filters were placed after trauma. Now the interesting part of that is that they were inserted when the highest risk for bleeding had already subsided, and anticoagulant therapy may very well have been appropriate at that time. So while many of these filters were placed because of a perceived contraindication to anticoagulation, kind of like the patient that I just talked to you about, 237 patients, that's about 25% of the group, were discharged on a regimen of anticoagulant therapy. So we sent home a quarter of the patients that we didn't think were going to be candidates for anticoagulation on an anticoagulation and with a filter in place, which now, based upon additional data, we know increases the risk of further embolism by double over the rate of not having the bloody filter in the first place. So you begin to see that we've really got an issue here that we're going to have to try to get a hold of. So with that in mind, the PREPIC 2 study came out. This was back in Journal of the American Medical Association back in 2015. This was, I like rounder numbers, so 399 to be honest, but let's just round it off and say 400 patients with acute DVT with or without pulmonary embolus who had one or more additional risk factor for recurrence. So they were 75 years of age or older. It gets a little younger every year to me. They have active malignancy. They have right ventricular dysfunction. And we could probably all sit here and probably name about six or eight other things that would be factors in that as well. They were randomized to filter versus no filter with retrieval in those patients who had the filter at 3 months post-placement. All of these patients are going to receive 6 or more months of oral anticoagulation at the investigator's discretion. So the question we're going to answer is, in the post-acute setting, does that filter do anything to help you? And you're going to be on anticoagulation in addition to that. What does the filter contribute in that particular setting? So here's what they found. The risk of recurrent pulmonary embolus was double in the filter group versus the non-filter group. Remember, the thing's only in for 12 weeks, right? Proximal DVTs were about equal. Isolated distal DVTs, again about equal. And isolated superficial venous thrombosis, one number higher in the no-filter group. So I think that probably, as far as any sort of statistical study, numbers are probably too small to be able to make any sort of determination. So from PREPICT 2, this is a relatively recent study, the takeaway in this population is that in patients with pulmonary embolus who are at a high risk of recurrence, the routine placement of a retrievable IVC filter doesn't reduce the risk of recurrent pulmonary embolism compared with anticoagulation alone. So those patients who receive IVC filters should have them because they have contraindications to anticoagulation. Applicability to certain other patients' groups is uncertain because they didn't feel like they had enough to make a statistical correlation based upon the numbers of patients that they saw in that particular study. So, at the end of all of this, as we kind of wrap up here, we might think about what potential uses we might have for IVC filters. We might think about that patient who has acute venous thromboembolism and an inability to anticoagulate. We might think about those patients who have persistent recurrent pulmonary emboli despite successful anticoagulation. Again, we might think about that hemodynamically unstable patient as an adjunct to anticoagulation in the acute setting. We might think about the patient who has that massive pulmonary embolus that's been treated with thrombolysis or thrombectomy. You don't do that to just anybody. It's the most critically ill of these patients. And so to protect them for a short period of time until we can get through the acute setting, it might be reasonable. Or for those patients who have some sort of thromboendarterectomy, that would be appropriate as well. We might consider it for prophylaxis in those high-risk populations. We saw that to some extent in the PREPICT 2 data. We might think about those patients who have mobile thrombus, particularly in the distal IVC itself. And we might think about those patients who have had an ileocaval DVT as well. So to kind of wrap all of this up, there is evidence that prophylactic insertion of IVC filters preoperatively can be harmful rather than helpful. There's data to suggest that filters that are placed in many high-risk situations really aren't helpful. In fact, it will increase the risk of thromboembolic disease. When filters are necessary, when removable filters where you can take them out at some point when the greatest risk has passed and the device has done what job we've asked it to do, those are much preferred. And when I'm educating students and residents and fellows about this, my comment to them is, when you put this in, you need to start the plan for when you're going to take it out. And that needs to be a part of your care plan for that filter. Retrievable filters should be removed as soon as the risk for pulmonary embolus has been resolved, or when anticoagulation can be safely resumed. So it's important to think about when you're going to get this device out. So I think we understand a little bit better now the indications for IVC filter placement. We need to carefully select and carefully consider this patient population and not have a general thought about who might benefit and who might not. We want to be able to describe the complications as a result of IVC filter placement. Well, we've talked about a number of them. Our ID colleagues who spoke to us just a few minutes ago talked about increased risks of things for infection and things that we do and devices that we implant. Colleagues who just spoke ahead of me, we talked about trying to do benevolent things with transfusion and increasing the risk of infection. This is an indwelling device, and so there's a risk of infection here as well. We also want to outline a strategy for management of IVC filters in those patients who are appropriate. We want to make sure that we're taking them out whenever it's appropriate. I want to thank you for your attention, and I believe we've got an opportunity for a question and answer session. So I'll hang out and be happy to answer whatever questions you have.
I want to invite Dr. Keir back up. There's a couple microphones throughout the room. Also, there's no lunch session today, so the plenary sessions will resume at 1:15. If anybody has a question, please find your way to the microphone.
It's taco time. I do have a question.
Please go ahead.
So you run across a patient, or I run across a patient in the clinic who's had an IVC filter placed 5 years ago, still has it in. What do you do with these patients? They're stable, but now maybe they need an upcoming surgery or something. Or if they've had it for 5 years, do you just keep it in?
Yeah, it's a real struggle. And unfortunately, many of those filters were placed back in the day when permanent filters were pretty much the norm. So short of a surgical procedure to remove them, you're kind of stuck with that thing for the long term. And if there's concern for bleeding risk or thrombotic risk, you're exposing the patient to an unneeded surgery. So I think in that particular unique setting, my thought would be to leave the device in and just manage them. And as long as they're symptom-free, then you're probably going to be okay. If you're concerned about thrombosis, you know, these are probably patient populations where you've already considered some sort of risk reduction strategies. And so, you know, aspirin, you might have them on Plavix or something along those lines. So you're probably doing those things medically already that would lower risk.
Hello. I had a patient recently that had multiple comorbidities, but basically a fellow came in, 65 years old, came in with a fresh pulmonary embolism from a long travel history, DVT. He did well. We treated him with Lovenox, switched him to Xarelto. So about 2 weeks later, he decided to come in with a perforated diverticulum and ended up with sepsis. We switched him right away from Xarelto to IV heparin, and then he ended up having to have immediate surgery. So we sent him, and I'm at a small hospital, so we sent him to our university hospital where they were able to do a bowel resection, colostomy. They didn't put a filter in at that time, and he came home back home on Xarelto and did well. Recently, he had his colostomy reversed, and the surgeon, who was a different surgeon, decided to put in an IVC preoperatively, even though he was doing well. And I kind of questioned it, but I said, well, he's the big guy. So I said, okay, we'll let him put it in. So he put it in. He's doing okay. But then he had an ultrasound, and they actually stopped the Xarelto and didn't restart him. We did an ultrasound. He had a recurrent DVT of his lower extremity. Of course, we restarted the Xarelto. So apparently they're leaving that in, but I didn't know if I should be pushing for him to have the IVC taken out. And the other question is that when you say contraindication to anticoagulation, how long is that contraindication? In other words, can you just hold your breath for the perioperative time for 24 hours and not put the filter in? Should you put the filter in and take it out in a week? What do you think? Sorry.
Yeah. Boy, I thought this was going to be easy. And I think we all see these challenging cases. You know, it's just the nature of our work. So what I'm hearing you say is that this is a patient who has really had a challenging course over the course of the last several months. He's been in and out of the hospital, has had multiple surgical procedures, has been doing okay with anticoagulation, but boy, those doggone surgeons just can't leave him alone. And so...
Well, God bless him too, but yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, there is an argument that you could make to keep the filter in until he's kind of through this phase of his life, and hopefully he's getting to the end of that fairly soon. So it's reasonable to make an argument to leave the device in at this point. It's really hard to know if he had his second event, that more recent DVT, based upon the filter being in place, based upon his post-operative course, based upon his age and comorbidities, but it's clearly a more complicated patient. And so this is a patient that I think you could probably make an argument for leaving in a retrievable filter until he can get through this episode. And then I think probably the next step would be to see about making a plan to get the filter out once he's back on his feet and he's cleared. And I would probably draw the line at 3 months after his last event if he's otherwise doing well. You could make the argument to continue the Xarelto for an additional 3 to 6 months after the filter comes out. And then after that, obviously a long-term anticoagulation strategy. It may be appropriate to look at aspirin-based therapy or something along those lines. Plavix would be another potential consideration. We don't have a lot of data, unfortunately, in that particular population. So those are all potential considerations, I think, for that guy. I'm sure wish you the best.
Oh, he's doing well. And then one other question, reflecting back and not trying to say should they have done this or that. Mm-hmm. So he's on heparin, IV heparin, goes down, has his hemicolectomy done. And of course, they didn't put an IVC in then. Would you have recommended an IVC in the fact that he had a DVT and PE 2 weeks before when they were doing the surgery? Or was just having him on IV heparin and stopping it and 6 hours later taking him to surgery adequate?
Yeah, I think it could make an argument to go either way. I mean, if it's a fresh clot within 6 weeks, you know, you could make an argument to put the filter in because that's a temporary situation. And surgery hopefully will be a temporary recovery period. So you could make an argument to put a filter in for a 3-month period of time until he's back up on his feet again and then take it out.
Thank you.
You bet.
This is more of a transfusion question. Post-operative patients, an example would be a total knee with anemia, follow-up with fatigue, and say, hemoglobin around 8. They're not getting up, getting functional like they should be after their surgery. Then you question, okay, so should you just use iron replacement? Is it better to use oral or infusion of iron to try to reestablish, their blood so that they would be up and functional more quickly?
So, you know, there's, of course, other things that probably go into it, whether there was blood loss with surgery, whether they have congestive heart failure, whether they have coronary artery disease, and the cardiologist calls you and wants their hemoglobin around 9. But in a standard healthy person with a hemoglobin of 7 with iron deficiency, I would likely recommend iron replacement first. And you have to start with oral and let the gut work and see if it improves them. And after several weeks, the hemoglobin will come up, as long as, of course, there's no GI pathology that's hiding somewhere in there to make them also iron deficient. But I really would recommend trying the oral therapies first, especially if it's not a blood loss anemia, you know, because he bled out severely during hip surgery. If it is, then transfusing him could be the right thing to do. So it really is individualized. Sorry, I'm not trying to be wishy-washy on purpose, but.
What is the risk of iron replacement and infections?
So the iron, I actually haven't read any literature recently on infection. There's a big risk of an allergic reaction, and it depends on the iron preparation that you give them. There could be a risk of anaphylaxis, and typically those patients are monitored at least for a short period of time after infusion. But most patients tolerate it excellently. There's 3 or 4 different preparations that at least we use, and you know, I'm sure that you guys use the same ones. The only complication I've personally had is anaphylaxis.
Do we have any last questions? Okay.
I do have one last question, a medical student question, and it's been a while since I've been a medical student. So with the new anticoagulants, as well as patients still on warfarin, which of the prothrombotic medical conditions can you still test for while they're on anticoagulants? So things like the antiphospholipid antibody, the factor V, all those things. Do you have to take them off of any of the anticoags to test?
Well, you know, it's kind of a good news, bad news situation. For factor V Leiden and the prothrombin gene mutation, there's genetic testing available, so you don't have to take them off of any anticoagulation to test for those. If you're looking for other things, if you're looking for other factor deficiencies in there on warfarin, that's a real challenge because it's going to affect 2,7,9,10 protein C and protein S. So you can't test for protein C or protein S in that particular setting, although it will probably be developing genetic tests that look at that that more specifically in the very, very near future, if they're not out already. I haven't recently reviewed that data, but I know that they're kind of coming down the developmental pipeline. As far as some of the other tests for prothrombotic things, things like antiphospholipid syndrome and things like that, the real challenge I think that we have is that a lot of those tests initially get done in the hospital when a patient presents with an unprovoked DVT or a pulmonary embolus and you're sort of working them up. I think if you get them in the acute setting, you know, before you do anything, and so they're standing there with the bucket and the phlebotomist has got the needle heading for the antecubital fossa, hey doc, what else do you want? It's certainly reasonable to do some screening tests at that point. You may not be able to do more detailed studies, but you might be able to get a general sense. After that, you kind of have to wait a few weeks after the acute event has subsided and do serial testing, because the question oftentimes is not just do they have phospholipid antibodies, and we kind of lump this into, and we bring the lupus anticoagulant into that as well, but phospholipid antibody syndromes, we also want to take a look at that sort of in the convalescent setting and then out and back when the initial events have subsided, because the real question that we have is not just do I anticoagulate after the acute event, but what do I need to do for the long term? And in many of those cases, we'll have to test with patients on certain medications. I don't really have any reason to suspect that as a result of the direct-acting oral anticoagulants, or DOACs as we sometimes call them, that we're going to have substantial limitations because of the way they work in the clotting mechanism. They work to inhibit clotting factors rather than to decrease or increase their levels. So we should be relatively safe.
Yeah, and we hope that testing was done before, but we don't usually have those records in the clinic.
Yeah, that's very true. And of course, we've got some challenges because our specialty society also has some definite recommendations in terms of testing for those, thrombophilia testing and that sort of thing. So if there's any questions about that or you're not sure where to go, hematology.org, and you can click on the Choosing Wisely pull down and it will be able to explain it, and they actually have their evidence base for it, the literature that they've reviewed to come up with that consensus statement, so it can be very helpful to your evaluation.
And I would add one thing on that. So if you don't know when things were drawn in relation to the results, if you ever see a protein C and protein S that's low, that would raise a lot of red flags if they're both low, because those are really rare, you know, inherited diseases, so to have both of them in the same patient, it's usually an issue of the acute event is causing that, or there's some sort of anticoagulation on board.
I was struck by the comment you made earlier that in the placement of filters, even in spite of using anticoagulation, there was a higher rate of thromboembolism, including PEs. That being said, now we're taking the filter and putting it in a patient who can't be anticoagulated. And to me, it raises the question of, do we have any proven benefit in those situations? Should we even be doing that if there's already a higher rate of PEs and thromboembolism in spite of using anticoagulation along with it?
So the challenge is, what's the risk of DVT or pulmonary embolus with the filter versus without, versus what do I think the patient's total risk is going to be? So if there's a increase in risk with the filter going in, but I substantially lower this patient's overall risk, even with that slight increase in risk, it's a balancing act as much as anything. And, you know, the challenge I think that we have is that it ultimately gets down to a judgment call on the basis of the physician. You know, based upon my review of the literature and my clinical experience, I feel that the benefit that I get in lowering this patient's overall risk of thromboembolic disease is going to offset any slight increase in risk that I would get as a result of the foreign body being in and being a stimulus to the clotting process to begin with. It really is, and it unfortunately, it sort of defies our logic, because if we come away from this looking at a lot of other problems, the benefit seems clear even though we know there's a risk of certain other things happening. Here it feels like we're lowering the risk but raising the risk at the same time, and that doesn't feel good. But I think it probably clearly articulates our heartburn issue with these devices right now, and the discomfiture that I think a lot of people feel, it's definitely mutual, because I talk with my colleagues all the time about this, and their discomfort with this is very genuine as well.
All right, well, thank you very much for your attention.